When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Last time, we heard the bone-chilling story of Michelle Gomez, who, in 1988, crossed paths with a sinister fellow teenager in Lockhart, Texas. This newcomer, Mary Rayner, wasn't just creepy. She seemed to possess supernatural abilities and claimed to be a member of a satanic cult in another Texas town called Childress, a cult that she claimed had blood on its hands. After Mary finally left Lockhart, Michelle was haunted by these cult stories, wondering if they were real or just made up. Troubled, she contacted the police, who were astonished when they heard her claims. Mary's sinister stories matched real locations, including an unsolved hit-and-run murder in Childress. And yet, most horrifying of all was the recent death of Tate Roland, a 17-year-old boy found dangling from a desolate tree. Tonight, the story moves from Lockhart, Texas, to the north, to the source of it all, Mary's hometown, Childress, where a series of eerie events would unfold that would spread fears of the devil and cult murder. But when yet another body is discovered, and when the locals discover who that body is, they cannot believe their ears. Join me as we visit a small town plunged into a state of terror, everything woven around a disturbing yet relentless question. Was a satanic cult committing ritual murder in their midst? I'm Peter Laws, and this is Satanic Panic in Texas, the mysterious deaths of Tate Roland and Terry Trosper. Tate Roland's death on the tree was ruled as self-inflicted, and the police department had no intention of investigating it further. For them, the case seemed tragic, yet simple. They had a witness. Tate's friend, Chad Johnston, had claimed that he and Tate had been near the tree drinking beer on the 26th of July, 1988. Chad said that Tate had started talking about his own funeral and who might turn up for it. Chad listened to this and assumed he was kidding. And then he went to throw a beer can away. He also needed to urinate in the bushes. But when Chad returned from this, he said he saw Tate with the rope wrapped around the branch, and he realized all the funeral talk had been more than just idle chatter, and he saw Tate go through with it. Well, that's what he told police. With a witness statement like this, the police were content to class this death as self-determined, and yet friends and relatives were confused. Childress, and especially back then, is a relatively small community. Back in 1988, they had a local cinema that only required to be open on two nights a week. That was enough so that everyone in Childress could come and see a movie, so that'll give you an idea of how big it is. And this small-knit community all seemed to know Tate Roland. Some thought he was a bit of a tearaway or a rabble-rouser, but many people really liked him. And they also saw, crucially, how happy he was in his life. He was very popular. He had lots of girls interested in him. It's true that he had broken up with a girl called Karen Hackler earlier that year, but his friends said that apart from a few times of admitting the breakup had bummed him out, he seemed to have bounced back from that pretty quickly. On the day of his death, Tate had shown no signs of depression or sadness. Indeed, he had even made plans. At around 5 on that afternoon, he was seen in the parking lot of the United Supermarket. He was happily chatting to some girls and offering to meet them later in the city park. He said he would offer to coach for their women's league softball team. He also spoke to a friend called Bobby Reynolds that day and told him that he wanted to meet up later that night to share a 12-pack of beer. But after that, he got into the car with his younger friend, Chad Johnston, who I just mentioned. And 1 hour later, he was found dead on the tree. Yes, it is possible that people who go through trauma do mask it in front of other people. I do know that can happen. But to his friends and family, and even to many people who were just aware of him in Childress, the sheriff's verdict did not make a lot of sense. There were also remarks said about Chad Johnston, who discovered him. When he described the events of that night to the police, he was supposedly said to have done it in a weirdly cold and matter-of-fact way, that there was no emotion to it, no sense of shock at a clearly upsetting incident. Now, again, people can act strangely when in shock, and Chad was only 15 at the time, Tate was 17. But he still acted in a way that was odd to many of the people around him. For example, not long after Tate's death, Chad started coming to the grieving parents' house, making weird demands. He said that before death, Tate had said that Chad should get Tate's car after he was gone and other things. Tate's parents, Jimmy and his stepmom, Brenda Rowland, were disgusted at this and kicked Chad Johnston out. Chad and his family eventually moved out of the area soon after. But it wasn't just Chad's behavior that cast doubt on the sheriff's conclusion about this case, because there was one other person who still had something rather compelling to say about it. Tate Rowland himself. The vast majority of people who watch this show are not subscribed, and that's fine, but it really can help me grow my channel. And so if you're up for it, and if you like this stuff, and you want to see more videos like this, I wonder if you might consider doing that little tap on the subscribe button. Don't smash the subscribe button like people say, because you know that you'd ruin your screen. Just a gentle tap would suffice. Thanks. Tate's body had been photographed at the hospital, and in the picture there were clearly two sets of rope marks on Tate's neck. One above and one below the Adam's apple. Now, normally, not always, but normally, in any self-inflicted tragedy, the rope will often slide up and over the Adam's apple, and so to have two marks didn't quite fit with what Chad had said. If a piece of rope had been tight enough to make this higher mark, why was there a lower one? Unless, of course, Tate was strangled with the rope first and then strung up after to make it look self-inflicted. Can you remember when Mary shared her story to Michelle and she said the group had taken two attempts with Tate and the rope? In light of these marks, the police interviewed Chad again, and this time he changed his story. He admitted that, okay, yes, Tate had tried it twice, but the rope broke on the first go, and after the first attempt, Chad said he went back with Tate to Tate's house to get a new rope, and they went back out so Tate could try again. Why on earth did Chad not say this the first time around? Well, he told police he was terrified that he would get into trouble for not stopping Tate, and so he didn't mention it. The sheriff's department accepted this explanation and ruled that the death was fully Tate's doing. Tate's family and some locals were still not impressed or convinced, and were frustrated when an autopsy wasn't even called. But instead, Tate's body was then released for burial, which is when the weirdness began. Tate Rowland was buried at 2 p.m. at the end of July in 1988 at Calvary Baptist Church in Childress, and the funeral was strange. Firstly, a mysterious woman turned up at the service dressed all in black. She even had a veil across her face. Nobody knew who she was, and she left before anyone could talk to her. Who was this mysterious stranger? Well, later it was discovered that actually it was an old friend of Tate's stepmother, Brenda. But at the time, people just saw this mysterious woman standing in black and started whispering, "Who is this person? Why is she here?" But then during the packed service, a young man in attendance began to act strangely. He started chanting a word over and over. Now, it's a word that I can't really say, as it can end up flagging as inappropriate. So let's just say it's the word beginning with S that describes what the police said Tate had done. You understand, right? So this young man started chanting that word over and over and over again, midway through the service. Some of the sources I found said he even climbed up on one of the pews and walked back and forth, saying it over and over again during the funeral service. So there was already a buzz around that. There was something, some odd energy about Tate's death and service afterwards, which grew even stranger a few days later when the Childress Police Department got a tip from a high school student. And so the police drove back out to Box's Corner and to the horse apple tree where it had happened and they discovered something shocking. A couple of hundred yards away from the site, lodged into the branches of another smaller tree, was a cow's skull, and below it was a stack of logs surrounded by rocks. The policeman that day openly described this as some sort of, quote, altar. It was revelations like this that led to a rumor sweeping through the town that Tate Roland had been the victim of a satanic cult. With all of this in mind, the police decided to keep an eye on Tate's grave, and they started to see things. One night, a police officer was out on patrol when he noticed something unusual in the graveyard. A figure was standing by Tate's grave in Childress Cemetery. Curious, the officer decided to check and eventually parked up, but when he went to investigate, whoever it was gone. But the officer did find spittle all over Tate's headstone. Now, it's a stone that features an oval-shaped illustration of Tate in life. It was covered in spit. Why? A little while after that, another report came in saying that a burning cross had been discovered placed on the grave. And then news came in that a local teacher's dog had been stolen and was found to have been killed in circumstances that looked shockingly like a ritual sacrifice. Now, we have to be careful here. All this could easily have been done by pranksters or local kids caught up in the gothic drama of this tragedy. Indeed, the local kids did enjoy shocking pranks. You know, you may not have heard of the town Childress, but if you've seen the film, the 1974 classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you may have heard the name. A character in that film mentions the town when a man pretends to help a frightened girl by telling her, "There's no phone here, we have to drive over to Childress." So because of this sad Texas chainsaw link, the local kids would often tell stories about a mad killer on the loose in this town, and people would prank each other based on this killer. Tate Roland himself had even once borrowed a chainsaw and chased some girls through the cemetery while dressed in a mask and overalls, though he did remove the chain. But yes, what I'm saying is I don't think it's unreasonable to say that all of these spooky ritualistic events after the funeral were maybe locals getting caught up in the spooky mood of it all, you know, teens pranking others, who knows? But also for other people, these events were a clear and frightening sight that what had happened to Tate at the apple tree was not a prank at all. Rumors were now rife that Tate had become a member of an actual cult. The rumors became quite detailed, too. In the town bars and school playgrounds, people were huddling together and sharing what they believed was the reason why Tate had died. Apparently, it was said, the cult had asked him to bring them a blonde-haired, blue-eyed child to be sacrificed. Even worse, it was said they specifically told him that he had to choose it from one of his relatives. This meant the child would either be one of his stepmother's daughters or from his own sister. Tate refused to bring a child to the group, and so they turned on him instead. That was the story going around the high school corridors of Childress. Now, I have no idea where this claim about the blonde child came from, and I don't fully know how widely it went. So if you're from Childress, I'd love to know if you've ever heard of this side of it. But what I do know is that a district attorney called David McCoy went on record to say that, related to these rumors, there were apparently some child abduction rumors going around at the same time too. Actual reports of strangers turning up to pick up kids in the grade school parking lot. And McCoy was quoted as saying, "That's a dead gum fact." Well, when a community feels a sense of panic rising, fact can fuse with rumors as well as all-out fiction to create a genuinely confusing yet disturbing picture of what might or might not be actually happening in the town. And so, a sense of paranoia was starting to sweep through Childress like a fog, including a disturbing incident with some teens in the cemetery. Word was going around town that the cult were going to return to dig up Tate's body, and they would do it, of course, on Halloween night. Eight teenagers from the town decided to turn up that night to check on his grave. They didn't come on foot, but in a car. And driving that car was one of the high school football players. His name is unknown. The cemetery has small roadways in it. I've just looked at the maps this morning. And so, you know, the funeral cars have to be able to get to every point for burials and services. And so in the darkness, this football player rolled the car with all these teenagers in it through. And as they did that, one of the teens in the car said they could hear the sound of singing coming from somewhere in the graveyard. But soon after that, the teenagers felt a jolt of terror when out of nowhere they saw a set of car headlights flicking on, and it was right next to Tate's grave. These teens would later testify before a grand jury that the headlights scared them so much that they turned the car around and they raced out of the cemetery. But as they did, they could clearly see pentagrams drawn onto a cemetery shed. The sight of these occult symbols apparently made the group start screaming in the car. But they had more to scream about, because some of them turned to look back at the cemetery and they noticed that the car headlights near Tate's grave were moving, and quickly too. They'd been seen, and they were being followed right now by the car. The football player apparently hammered his car to get away, and the mysterious pursuers followed him through town all the way back to the courthouse. I checked the maps of Childress, which shows that the car chased them for just over a mile, which is about 4 minutes of pursuit. So the driver raced through town and eventually got to the local courthouse, like I said. And that is finally when the chasing car finally turned away and that the driver could breathe again. Now, looking at the maps, I'm a little surprised that the driver didn't rush straight for the sheriff's office. Because, you know, I guess I would have presumed that there'd be more likely to be someone up at night in the sheriff's office rather than the courthouse. The map shows that the sheriff's office is only, what, like 1 minute further? Now, true, maybe the driver panicked and had no plan. That's very possible. Or maybe he took a route to the sheriff's office that took him past the courthouse and then thankfully didn't have to go that far because the car left. Or maybe he didn't want to go to the sheriff's office for help for some reason. That's speculative, but, you know, who knows? But whatever the case, they shook off the pursuers. The football player returned to the cemetery the next day to find beer cans scattered around Tate's grave, but worse, this poor boy's headstone had been overturned. Journalist Skip Hollinsworth, who wrote a brilliantly detailed article about this case for the Texas Monthly magazine, interviewed the football player about what happened that night, and he was happy to tell the story until this football player suddenly realized that it was going to go into print, which is when he became terrified. He believed that the cult was sure to come for him next. Perhaps that's why Skip mentions many other names with photographs in that article, but not the football player. Anyway, this was not the end of the satanic rumors, because soon there would come a confession. Not long after Halloween, another teen called Ray Wilkes was out drunk driving when he smashed his car into a utility pole. When the 15-year-old was arrested, he made a rather disturbing confession to the officers. He told them that he was a member of the Satanist group that had killed Tate Roland, and he even said that he'd been at the fateful tree when it had happened. Apparently, there was something very strange about this confession and the aftermath, because the people in the jail that night would later go on record to say that there was something eerie or odd about the boy's voice when he told them this stuff, that it sounded weird, that the thing coming out of his mouth just didn't sound right. One officer was quoted as describing this kid's voice as very spooky. And yet when Skip Hollinsworth interviewed Ray Wilkes for his article, Ray denied knowing anything about the cult and said he'd just been drunk, or at least he had no memory of saying such things. But this police cell revelation caused locals to look at Ray Wilkes and his family with narrowed eyes. You see, the Wilkes family were known locally as having various criminal convictions, but could they be part of a murder cult? While suspicions of who might be part of the cult were going on in various parts of the town, and it was said that many of those who had got suspected did mysteriously seem to move out of the town not long after Tate's death, within about two months to 1 year of his death. Now, were they alarmed at being discovered, and so they were moving the cult out of town to set up somewhere else? Or did these people leave because of the stress of being accused by neighbors, even though they had done nothing wrong? I do think that's a fair suggestion. How would you feel if your neighbors were suddenly pointing their fingers at you and calling you a murdering devil worshipper? But the point was, the atmosphere was ripe for misunderstandings, particularly with the boy, Ray Wilkes, and his family. Especially when people saw a shocking message that had been scrawled on the exterior wall of the Wilkes' house. 44-year-old Frank Wilkes was the father of four sons, and all five of those people had been charged for various crimes in the past. The DA, David McCoy, called them, quote, a bunch of outlaws. Ray Wilkes had already told police in a state of drunkenness that he was a part of the group that had killed Tate, but this wasn't the only reason why people were suspecting him. You see, the Wilkes home had a blatant message drawn in paint on its wooden slats. Now, the writing wasn't perfect, so interpretations of the words were mixed, but the one word that seemed clear to all was this one: devil. Some said the message read, "The devil's den." Others that it was more like, "The devil's bin." A secretary for the courthouse was convinced that the words actually said, "We worship the devil." Now, Frank Wilkes admitted publicly that the message was written by his younger son, Ray. However, Frank had a different explanation for the message on their home, quote,
"Oh, well, he was trying to win the affection of a girl, so he wrote, 'I love Letty.' I said, 'Ray, you get that shit off the wall.' So he painted over it, and now everybody thinks it says, 'I love the devil.'"
Well, folks weren't only looking at the Wilkes family as potential demon worshippers. There were lots of other potential cult members, especially when the police carried out a search warrant at a rundown old house on the outskirts of town. The place was supposed to be a care home for people with disabilities, but the owner had been accused of abusing the residents sexually. The police searched the house, and they were shocked to find evidence of the occult in the man's bedroom, including pornography featuring a man in a goat's head mask having sex with a woman, but also a picture of the state of Texas that had been scrawled inside a pentagram. They also found his black cloak. Now, critics of the Satanic Panic would argue that this hardly means that this man was involved in some large-scale murderous cult conspiracy, and I do think that is an important caution to have. But discoveries like this only deepened the fear of the devil in Childress. By now, the rumor mill was just out of control and could not be stopped, with local kids starting to accuse each other of being cult members. It reminds me of the same virus-like spread of paranoia and accusation that we see in the Salem witch trials of 1692. Now, of course, in time, these things tend to run their course, and perhaps the fear of the devil and his acolytes would have faded away after a few months of this. But then, the story took a genuinely shocking twist. A woman was found dead at Frank Wilkes' house. That's troubling enough, but when the locals found out who had died, they could barely believe it. The corpse in Frank Wilkes' so-called devil house was Terry Trosper, whose maiden name was Terry Rowland. The dead woman was Tate Rowland's sister. Terry Trosper was older than Tate. She was in her mid-20s when he died. She was badly affected by his death, understandably, and had ended up becoming separated from her husband. She had also given up custody of her four daughters. Now, she was in her mid-20s when Tate died in 1988, and while the official report said there was nothing suspicious about it, she strongly disagreed. She was sure that he had been murdered, and she was committed to finding out who had done it. Now, like others in the town, Terry started to suspect that Frank Wilkes' boys and their friends may have something to do with this. Well, she became friends with the family and even slept with one of the family friends and hung out at their house a lot, perhaps as a way of gathering information. But the man she started to sleep with from this group was a 28-year-old ex-convict called Ricky Bradford. Ricky was a close friend of one of Frank's other sons, a 22-year-old called Darwin Wilkes. Well, she'd been drinking with this group on May the 30th, 1991, at the Wilkes house. But by the next morning, her now boyfriend, Ricky Bradford, found her dead in the bed. The pathologist examined the scene and ruled that she had died from, quote, choking on her own vomit. Remember that detail. Despite this verdict on her death, there were unusual items of evidence that seemed to get ignored. For example, there were drops of blood found on the pillow in Terry's bed, and also a small pool of blood on the bedclothes between her legs. The investigators just assumed Terry was due her period, but there was blood on the car as well. Just like in Tate's death, the Rowland family and others pressured the local sheriff to look at this as a potential crime, not an accident. And yet the county sheriff, the same one, Claude Lane, refused to do anything. He'd been similarly uninterested in Tate Rowland, which led to suspicions that he too might be part of the cult. Well, the news of Terry's death brought just an almost unbearable level of devastation to Tate's father, Jimmy Rowland. You see, as well as Tate and Terry, he'd had other children with multiple mothers. Yet the news about Terry meant that a staggering 4 of his children had now died. Yeah, Chandra Michelle Rowland had died in a car crash in 1967, aged 4. Jimmy Jamie Rowland died in 1969 from crib death. He was only 2 months old. And then Tate died at the tree, and now Terry. The Rowland family had been through an absolute nightmare, and they demanded an investigation into Tate and Terry's death, thinking that both deaths may well have been linked to these rumors of a cult. Once again, the sheriff, Claude Lane, refused to do anything about it, and it seemed like they were just hitting a brick wall, until something rather unexpected happened. Sheriff Lane was sent to jail himself for dealing marijuana. This meant a new sheriff came to town, Reese Bowen, a red-headed local, and along with his deputy, Kevin Overstreet, the two men looked at the rumors about Tate Rowland, and they just started scratching their heads over the inconsistencies and bad practice in the evidence gathering. They started to realize that perhaps the claims of murder could well be true, or at least were possible enough to be investigated. And so finally, they agreed to reopen the case of Tate Rowland. And as part of that investigation, Deputy Sheriff Kevin Overstreet even traveled to Lockhart to explore the drawings of Michelle Gomez, you know, the young woman who we looked at in the previous episode, who met the mysterious Mary Rayner and had drawn down simply what Mary had claimed. Overstreet was impressed enough with her drawings to travel all the way to Lockhart to meet with her. But as this was all going on, there was an unexpected turn in the case when one of the Wilkes boys couldn't take it any longer, and he had to speak out. You remember how Ricky Bradford was Terry's boyfriend at the time of her death? Well, he was good friends with Darwin Wilkes, Frank's son. A few weeks after her body was found, Darwin Wilkes tried to end things by taking 25 to 30 tablets of a mild antidepressant. He left a note which said,
"I know something that the cops don't know. I know who killed Terry. I can't live anymore."
Darwin attempted it, but he lived through it. He didn't die. He recovered. And a bit like Ricky Wilkes, who confessed to being part of a cult after being drunk and then denied it later, Darwin wrote this note when he thought he would die. After that, he said he had no memory of writing it and didn't believe it. Concerned with Darwin's shift in story, the new sheriff wanted him to take a lie detector test, and yet it never actually happened. Darwin left Childress and went to Dallas. And so they left it, because for now their focus was not so much on Terry, but on what had happened to Tate Rowland at the apple tree. And so, at the end of July 1991, 3 years after Tate's death, this new sheriff had Tate's body exhumed from Childress Cemetery. They carried out an autopsy, finally, with the express purpose to determine if the neck wounds had been self-inflicted or part of some kind of sacrifice. By now, the rumors of satanic worship and murder had spread to the media, and so camera crews and reporters came to Childress when the body of Tate was exhumed. The district attorney, McCoy, revealed to the reporters that he had recently received what he called a little old death threat. Someone had called him on the phone and had said, "If I were you, I would look out for my life." And then they hung up. He told a TV crew from Amarillo that being part of this case was, quote, "the stuff movies are made of." The reporters also interviewed a local who said that the cult members had been seen dancing around their bonfires on the shores of the prairie dog town Fork Red River, which is about 10 minutes drive to the north. Everybody's eyes were on the coroner's office, just waiting to hear what the results of the autopsy would be. And during the autopsy, the examiner made a disturbing discovery. They found traces of a drug in Tate's system. That drug is called Elavil. Elavil is a mild antidepressant that can treat mood and eating disorders and nerve pain. When I looked up the potential effects of someone having too much Elavil, it includes this list: drowsiness, confusion, agitation, delirium, seizures, coma. Tate's friends and family insisted that Tate never had anything to do with drugs, and they weren't aware of him being medicated for depression, as far as I know. Therefore, the police realized this could potentially support the theory that someone had sedated Tate before killing him. They also examined the two rope burns on his neck, and once again, the team could see why it could be argued that he may have been strangled with a rope before he was strung up from the tree. And yet, despite these intriguing discoveries, there was something wrong with Tate's coffin. The casket was just no longer airtight. And so after 3 years in the ground, his body was in a bad state of decay. And so it was difficult to find any definitive evidence that would really make a difference. The new sheriff started to realize how pathetic the original investigation had been, with no full examination of the scene of Tate's death and a kind of dismissal of the idea that there could be a group behind this. Whereas the DA, McCoy, was open to it potentially being cult-related because, you see, this was not McCoy's first experience of crime and cults. He had previously prosecuted a case in Panhandle, Texas, where a teenager had murdered her classmate and openly said that it was part of a satanic ritual. And so, in September 1991, the DA, McCoy, convened a grand jury to study the evidence of both Tate and Terry's murder. As part of that, a grand jury asked that Terry Trosper's body be exhumed too. And as a result of that, the new examiner questioned the previous verdict of choking on vomit. Why? Because Terry had been lying face down at the time of her death. How could she have choked? During the Halloween season of 1991, a new autopsy result was announced. Terry Trosper had not choked by accident. She had been, quote, forcibly smothered. And the bruises found on her arms and inner thighs indicated that more than one person may have done it. McCoy said that he thought one person had held her down while another had smothered her. Yet still, there wasn't enough evidence to get any actual indictments in her case. All this, of course, was just pumping more and more fuel into the theory of a cult in Childress, especially when they had two remarkable developments. Firstly, it was discovered that Darwin Wilkes had used a particular drug to try and end things. It was Elavil, the exact same substance found in Tate Roland's body in the autopsy. But during the autopsy of his sister Terry, it was discovered that she too had the same tranquilizing drug in her system. As you can imagine, when this information came out, the rumor mill in Childress apparently, according to these articles, went berserk. Now, I did find an article that said that Tate's cause of death was indeed changed from self-inflicted to strangulation. Yet, in the case of both him and his sister, too much time seems to have passed since they died, and the evidence collection at the death was so appalling that no evidence could be found that would definitively point to any particular killer or killers. Which only led to more and more people in Childress becoming convinced that the town was gripped by a demonic conspiracy. By now, many people believed that a cult really had been responsible for these two deaths. Rumors even spread that the cult was meeting in a mobile home factory and then possibly a dry cleaning store. Then a baby lamb was discovered with its heart cut out. There was even a report of a man from Childress who pointed at a cat and demanded that through the, quote, powers of Satan, it would die. And the cat dropped dead on command, apparently. The First Baptist Church in Childress responded to this situation by running a seminar on Satanism that was attended by 450 locals. Here, the locals were told by a self-proclaimed expert on the occult that heavy metal music was turning their teens into Satanism, and that their sons and daughters were apparently being taught by certain parts of culture to dig up coffins and have sex with the corpses. The Texas Department of Public Safety then distributed pamphlets to local police departments listing 30 ways people could tell if a death had been caused by satanic ritual abuse. But then in March of 1992, Ricky Bradford was at a barbecue with Darwin Wilkins. Remember, Bradford was the one who was in a relationship with Terry Trosper and had discovered her body. At this barbecue, Bradford told Wilkins that he had killed Terry. Ricky Bradford threatened to, quote, cut out Darwin's eyes if he told. But Darwin, who had almost checked out of his life because of this, still went with his father to the police, and Ricky was eventually arrested for first-degree murder. So was Bradford a lone killer and there was no cult after all? Perhaps. But a few days after Bradford's arrest, a white cat was discovered on the road out of town with its heart cut out. And then, just before Ricky's murder charge went in front of the grand jury, something disturbing happened to the DA, David McCoy. He had been receiving threatening messages since launching the investigation, yet those threats felt far more real when his house burned to the ground under mysterious circumstances. During Bradford's trial, a young woman called Betty Lewis took the witness stand, and she had been present at the house on the night Terry died. She told the jury that she had seen Ricky smother Terry that night. One of Ricky's cousins insisted he had a tape recording of Betty Lewis denying that she had ever seen Ricky do anything like that. But the tape was not clear enough to use in court, and the jury sided with Betty Lewis. They found her persuasive. Ricky Bradford was convicted of capital murder on November the 3rd, 1992. The rumors of devil worship continued, however, and got so bad that it affected the reputation of the town for a while. One woman from a nearby town stopped at Childress County Courthouse just to ask if it was safe to drive down Highway 83 at night. She had been told that was where the cult worshipped. A journalist from Amarillo came to town to cover the story, but insisted that they would have a gun with them to protect themselves from the cult members. And so, was there a satanic cult at work in Childress? Well, as you've heard, many people believed so, though nobody ever confessed to it. Yes, there were private individuals who were found with occult paraphernalia, yet there's no real law against that. Indeed, Satanism is recognized as a new religious movement, so we can't assume that somebody owning a cloak and a pentagram or whatever will automatically mean that they're part of some murderous cult conspiracy. And yet the case of Tate Roland and his sister Terry Trosper couldn't help but fuel the satanic panic, which had actually been sweeping across the world in the 80s and 90s, with people, often Christians, believing that the devil and his followers were out to corrupt and destroy the lives of their teenagers through rock music and Dungeons and Dragons games, horror films, He-Man, the Smurfs. Yes, all of these things became a target in that panic. Now, much of this was, in my opinion, a huge overreaction to popular youth culture. But to say that cult murder has never happened in the US, well, that's surely a bit naive. These things may not happen anywhere near as much as people claim they do, perhaps, but that doesn't mean they never happen. And there are certainly some troublesome details about this case that just makes you wonder, not least what Mary Rayner told Michelle Gomez in those horrible dreams she shared that became drawings that were eerily accurate. Remember, she came to Lockhart and told her stories of devil worship and sacrifice very soon after Tate was killed, before perhaps the satanic panic had really set in. Was Mary Rayner part of a dark cult? Did she have some sort of supernatural power, an ability to speak to her leader, the Thane, through a Ouija board like we talked about last time and cause the planchette to move on its own? In other words, might there be an actual supernatural darkness flowing through this entire story? Well, I'll leave that to you to decide. But eventually, the horse apple tree where Tate Roland was found back in 1988 was cut down by somebody. I don't know who. I'm not sure if anyone knows who cut it down, to be honest. Someone did. Because it's not there anymore. Not many people know the truth behind this case, either. Someone might. Whether those in the know are single individuals caught up in more run-of-the-mill, yet no less shocking murder and despair, or part of an entire group of organized people engaging in murder and ritual sacrifice, well, perhaps we'll never know. We're just left with the memory of Terry Trosper and Tate Roland, who, like the tree on Box's Corner, are no longer around to tell us. I'm Peter Laws, and you've been listening to Satanic Panic in Texas, the mysterious deaths of Tate Roland and Terry Trosper.